about to experience, Jackson Snyder presents. We will examine the life of our master, Yeshua, by discovering his ancestors, family, and friends, by reviewing rare ancient manuscripts, and speaking to those who know him best. From the Vero Essene Yahad, now experience Jackson Snyder presents.
Here's a little story about Feast of Tabernacles. Our feast this year is featuring Eddie Chumney, the Dancing Prophet. Make your reservations soon at www.feasts.us. Now, here's Bogdan. Bogdan, let me tell you about how you can see all your friends on Facebook, worship with them, and have a good time.
Oh, you know, Brother Snyder, I'm too old for that sort of thing. Besides, I don't have any friends.
But you will have friends. And you can't tell me that your work with the Yahad hasn't brought you a lot of friends.
Well, I guess a few. Like Jerry E. Lewis.
Yeah.
And Kim Basinger.
Of course.
And how about that Cary Grant? He's a big in old country.
Still?
Oh, yeah, he's been big since about 1935. So how can I meet these people and have all kinds of fun and worship with them even?
Well, you know, my friend, Feast of Tabernacles, Shavuot, is coming up soon.
Oh, yeah?
Oh, yeah, you know, every year you haven't made one yet.
Well, where is it this time?
It's in North Georgia, up in the beautiful mountains. I'm sure you've been there before. I love it there.
Oh, I can't climb a mountain at my age.
Yeah, you don't have to climb anything. You know, we have a van.
Well, how can I find out more about this?
You can listen to this commercial, or you can go to www.feasts.us. All the information is there. It's inexpensive. It's beautiful territory.
Oh, yeah, I know the Yahad has the best speakers and teachers.
But that's not all. There's fun, too. And we'll probably get to see a little bit of color at that time of year.
Color? What do you mean?
I mean the trees changing color.
Oh, it's not the trees that change color. It's the leaves.
www.feasts.us.
Oh, yeah, you mean www.feasts.us. You suppose Medicare will pay for it?
Oh, it depends on how you write it up.
I just didn't have the heart to tell him that Cary Grant's been dead since 1986.
So I guess we'll get started. Allison will come along soon enough. Tonight, I want to, for my portion, look a little more into the Elephantine-Jerusalem connection. And for that, I already have this information recorded, and I want to play that recording for you. And while I'm playing it, I'll put on some pictures as well that I found this week that are illustrative of primarily Panahasi, whom I had always considered to be the same as Joseph for a few reasons, which I'll explain here in this recording. Then we'll see who wanders along.
Now talk about the Elephantine Island Temple just a little more. The city that was made on Elephantine Island is called Yeb to this day. Yeb was existing in 400, 300, 200 BC, and the assumption is it went way on back earlier than that, and maybe a sanctuary city from those that fled from Akhetaten, because, as I said, they did build the temple there. The temple worship, I understand, was a mix like the Jeroboam mixed religion, and this is what they say, that they worship Yahweh and Yahweh's consort, Ashtaroth. Who knows for sure? What we know for sure is that there's a temple built there on that island. And the name of that temple, name of that city is Yeb, Y-E-B. In the same time period, if you go back to two sessions ago, we talked about the Jebusites and how I believe that when Jebus was conquered, before it became Jerusalem, by David, that there was a Melchizedek priest in there with his own temple, and that temple was dedicated to the El Elyon, the Most High. David took on the priest there named Zadok the priest in order to help to persuade the Jebusites to come into order. If they were...
Notice that this is a picture of Panhasi's tomb, and we'll see in a minute the a projection of the baptismal in there. Geb and Jebus. Geb, of course, is the same as Elephantine Island. And as I just said, there was a temple built there, a Hebrew-Jewish temple that we suppose was manned by those who were fleeing Akhetaten when it was torn down. And Jerusalem, the name before it became Jerusalem, was Jebus, J-E-B-U-S. Now, in the earliest texts, Melchizedek is not a name. It's two words, Melech Zadok, King Zadok. The priest of the Jebus temple that is designated by Scripture as a temple of El Elyon, even when the Jebusites were there, has a priest in there named Zadok. Of course, that name is a derivative of the word Zedekah, or righteousness. So we have a King Zadok years before, and we have a priest Zadok in Jebus that we suppose David took on once he conquered that area, probably with the help of that priest. And that's an explanation a little bit of where we're going with this. Now, what happened to my player? My player disappeared. Not good. My player disappeared. I have to go looking for this again.
Scholars refer to kind of. I'll tell you, I've only got one, so get prepared. All right, here it goes. I'm going to make Jackson.
We wrote to Heliopolis. I'm looking for an actual name, which I can't see. But Heliopolis, of course, is the home of the Onion Temple.
And this is the third Hebrew temple there.
Time of Onias the Fourth, that's about 175 BC, until the Romans finally destroyed their temple. But at that time, here in Heliopolis,
is that the one in 175?
Complete Yahweh's worship group that had a Zadokite priest and continued to have Zadokite priests while the Jerusalem temple. They put away the Zadokites and the usurpers came in.
Now that means that we have, over the course of 1,000 years, we've got a temple to Yahweh at Geb. We have one in Jerusalem, which was Jebus. And we have the Onion temple up in Heliopolis, the city of the sun.
This is something that we know very little about. We can read a little about it in 2 Maccabees. There's a letter in 2 Maccabees, somewhere right along the first couple chapters, where the people of the Jerusalem temple, the high priests or whatever, are writing to this breakoff group in Egypt and saying something like, look, we're going to celebrate Hanukkah. Obviously, these guys in Egypt did not like Hanukkah because it was one of the consequences that caused them to have to split off and leave in exile. And the discussion was about tabernacles, which is just before that. And the Jerusalem temple is saying to the Onion temple, why don't we patch this up? I'll tell you what, skip tabernacles this year and do Hanukkah. That will make everything right with us. But of course, that was not going to be the case. That's why it seems today do not celebrate Hanukkah. As you read in the Maccabees, that there was a group there called the Hasidim. Those were the Essenes, the pious ones. And after the Hasidim came in to help Maccabees to fight off the Greeks there and to regain the temple, the Maccabees turned on and massacred a bunch of Hasidim. And then, of course, a little before that, they had murdered the temple priest Onias III, last of the Zadokite priests, and this caused a split off. Part of them went to Egypt. The other part of the Zadokites and their allies went into the desert over here. And that's where we get the scrolls. We understand that those that were Zadokim among the priests that were exiled took the holy books from the Temple of Jerusalem with them in their exile. And of course, buried them so that we, in our day, could have a really clear picture of not only the history of that time, but also some very intimate accounts of one that was called the Teacher of Righteousness. We'll go down here to Akhetaten or Tel El Amarna. Smyrna. This was a desert wasteland. Akhenaten left Thebes, which was, of course, a sprawling big city where the pharaoh lived, and went upstream here, or downstream, to this wilderness area, built a city, Akhenaten. Let's see, what does that mean? It means the horizon of the sun, and built within that city the largest temple.
I don't think I have the right one yet. Crap. I'm sorry.
The Phantom Elder, Chris Plure, right here he is. Chris Ames, son of Alf Place, where they not only had indoor seating for the masses that would come, but also outdoor seating as well. I would be surprised if they had cameras there and the whole thing projected all out. If some of these ancient alien stories are true and the technology of that time, we'll go into some more detail on Akhenaten and the Great Temple there. Abydos is another place that's mentioned in the Apocrypha. There were lots of Hebrews here. Luxor, of course. We get on down here a little bit. We have Elephantine Island. This is important for our study, too, because 3rd and 4th century and before, there were lots of Hebrews here, and they, too, went out on an island here. But we got the Aswan out. But the island still exists, even though they flooded that area. And they built another temple there to Yahweh, and supposedly celebrated the way that the temple service was supposed to go, as well as they had Zadokite priests in here. Go down a little farther, right over the border here, to a place called Alphae, not on this map because it doesn't exist anymore. You've heard me tell about the Alphae priesthood and how I believe that's connected with the New Testament moniker, James, son of Alphaeus, or Matthew, son of Alphaeus. I understand that the Alphaeus doesn't mean their uncle. I think it means they were of the Alphae priesthood.
This is Elephantine.
That priesthood, that it was a dynastic
Alphaeus down here.
Healing.
Right about here.
Manipulate the weather, and exactly the same things that James the Just known for in the church histories. So the connection is too close. I understand Alphae as being a sanctuary city for those that were fleeing Egypt, especially those that might have been fleeing Akhenaten.
You don't find it on the map because when Nehru flooded the Aswan area, Alphae was flooded as well. So it's under a mile of water right now.
Count of the Akhenaten part of the dynasty only lasted.
That's a lot of water. Does it say how he flooded it?
Place and pull it all down, and you can just bet.
Nehru? Yes, he cut out the rock around the Nile River. And the Nile River all went in there. That's about 1959, I think. President Nehru was very against the West and Israel, and they wanted to make a reservoir down there. So they took all those cities in South Egypt around the Aswan area, and they just flooded that area completely using the Nile River. And all the remnants of the Alphae in Alphae that was just at the northern edge of Sudan was all flooded. They didn't even excavate it or anything, or any of the other cities around there. They just flooded it all. So we can't get in there and find out anything else about the Alphaeus priesthood.
Hebrews were everywhere, fleeing north and south. That's how we got Hebrews up here in Goshen. It's right in this area where Moses was raised up, and that would be Goshen's probably 200 here. Years after the Akhenaten pharaoh time. I'm a little nervous, but yeah, I had one more thing I wanted to show on here.
Here's Heliopolis.
Oh yeah, Alphaeus said was gone because Nehru flooded the Nile Valley.
There you go.
Created the Aswan Dam, and one of the places that had to go was the ruins of Alphae. Therefore, we can't look into that area anymore to find out exactly who was there and how this connects with the family of Yahshua. Gone, all underwater now. They moved the town a little to the east, or to the east, but still it's not the same geographic area as it was then. And so that is gone. Elephantine, of course, the actual town that was on the island was called Yeb. want you to keep that in mind, because this is part of the connection here that goes back to Jerusalem. Karnak is a ruin that we're looking at from through archaeological lenses these days. Thebes was where the capital was in the 13th and 14th century BC, and that's about it. You know, this is the Sinai here, and we go up Israel up here in the corner. I would like to give you a link to this map. It's the best one I've ever seen for this kind of study, so I'll put that on the chat right now. In case you want to scarf that up and put it on your computer.
There's Jeebus. That's Chris Plourd.
My friends, if you have a feckless platitude during this time, first write in and give it to us. I want to see who's on here tonight. I want to be able to give you a good grade for attendance. Very nice. Welcome, Ray Osher, new elder in the Ahad. I'm going to get out my pack of notes here because I know you are waiting with bated breath for this particular presentation. Some scholars refer to Qumran as the Qumran Hilton because there are 15 major theories of how that property was used in the ancient times, and evidently 14 of those must be wrong. It's been touted as a fortress or a sea resort or a pottery shop or a scriptorium. Nobody knows for sure. But one thing that seems to be evident about Qumran, according to the things that have been found in that area in the ruins, is that the people who were writing the scrolls, the Ahad, and collecting those books lived there in Qumran. It may seem pretty obvious to you, but also there's been many theories about where those people were living. Mostly it's thought that they were living in caves outside there, that the Qumran ruin was not actually a monastery or anything like that. Of course, we have to remember, too, that all these people that were assigned to the initial scrolls team were monastics, with the exception of one or two. So they saw Qumran and its people through the eyes of the monastery. Now, even today, that idea still continues on, that it was a monastery there that had a scriptorum and some mikvot and other things like that. I don't feel that way. I certainly don't think it was a monastery, but it may be a headquarters of what we would call today zealots or freedom fighters or even terrorists, assassins. We read about the Sicarii and the zealots for the Torah being holed up in Masada in that fortress for a long time before the Romans were able to breach those walls. But by the time they breached, you remember that there were like 900 people there that had committed suicide, one kind or another, ostensibly because they didn't want to be captured and put into slavery by the Romans. This was evident because of, what do they call them? What was back in the election? What did they call those things that were hanging? Chads? Chads. Yeah, there were chads up there, pieces of pottery, where they had the names of several of the ones that were up there. Evidently, they wrote the names on there, and they passed them around and decided who would kill who.
This is in Panhasi's tomb. Remember, there's a baptismal in there. And you can see that this is Akhenaten here that's been defaced. But the earlier picture I showed of the Aten with the rays, that's still in there. I don't know if you can see the picture or not. I hope so.
No.
Jack, why was it defaced?
Yeah, there's no picture coming through.
No picture coming through. All right.
Jack, why was the statue defaced?
Because the ones that came after Akhenaten, I guess, hated him. But we don't really know. That's just speculation. But all of Akhenaten's stuff was defaced that they could find. And this is a good example of it here in Panhasi's tomb. However, this was done before there was an assembly in this place of early Nazarene believers. They kept the rest up. They could have torn the rest down. But instead, they put a baptismal in there. Let me show you that. Can you see this picture? No, you can't.
Share it. You have to share it.
Here's the apse. Here's a baptismal. And it goes down to what appears to be about 5 feet. So whatever went in there, people were dunked. It's just big enough for a person or two. I had a hard time finding this picture. I looked and looked. There might be a couple more here. These are all Panhasi's tomb. Blueprints. There's another possibility right there. There, we can see what that mikvah looked like. We don't know what scale it is, how wide it is, but I found the first survey of the tombs of Akhetaten, copyright 1905, and I was able to download that whole survey, and I haven't read it yet, but we'll find out how wide that is. Looks like this is a covering of sorts, but in that tomb also we have the Aten disc and the rays. Those are not defaced. This looks to me, in this apse, like a religious figure, as was common in synagogues in those days. You can't tell what it is, but you can tell pretty much we've got a head here, and this looks like wings or something, and a body. Apo, are you going to present tonight, Allison?
I have a little bit, but it doesn't run, I don't think, a half hour.
Okay, why don't you go on then?
All right. I'm still working on the book, The Moses Mystery, The Egyptian Origins of the Jewish People by Gary Greenberg. And I finished the whole book, and I'm going to give you the gist of it. And if anyone wants some particulars, we can go back into that. But after I read his conclusion, I will give you my take on it. It's an interesting theory. So give me just a moment to find my place. And I apologize for being late. I had to work late.
That's tasty.
All right. All right. The stories of the 12 tribes in the account of the Canaanite conquest, the Bible itself is extremely inconsistent and contradictory, and frequently draws on myths and traditions rather than on actual history. Much of the writing of biblical history by the Hebrew scribes has been heavily affected by the passage of time and tremendous local cultural influences, including such traumatic events as the destruction of the northern kingdom of Israel and the Babylonian captivity of the southern kingdom of Judah. Therefore, he's going to set forth the simple narrative of what he believes to be the true story of the origins of ancient Israel. This is the very end of the book, and he recaps it all. So this is what this guy believes that he's proved. And I'll just give you the premises here. When Akhenaten came to the throne at about 1374 BC, Egypt's stranglehold over Canaan started to loosen. Pressures from the Hittites in the north emboldened many of the local Canaanite rulers to challenge Egypt's political authority. In the forefront of this rebellion stood Labiah, the king of Shechem, who, with his sons, established a modest empire that dominated much of central Canaan, loosely corresponding to what later came to be known as the Joseph territories of Ephraim and Manasseh. The house of Israel did not yet exist.
That's up in Galilee, right?
I think so.
Ephraim and Manasseh?
I believe so. I'm not really great on that. So if Daniel or somebody knows, great, for sure. Remarkably, Akhenaten did little to counteract the foreign revolts and generally ignored his allies' calls for help. Under his reign, Egypt's Canaanite empire collapsed. Oh, and as a side note, I think a couple of weeks ago I was talking about the art, and I was saying that one of the reasons that it's postulated that the artwork was different was because there was a more naturalistic look and a more less formal and religious look to all the artwork, because there was a developing merchant class basically right at the start of the decline of the Egyptian influence in the Palestine and Syria areas, and in Ethiopia, because they were merchants. The queen, hold on, I gotta find her name. Hatshepsut, was that the queen, Jackson?
Yeah.
Okay, she was. I saw a really interesting video on Amazon Prime about Moses in the Akhenaten time period. It's about Egypt and the Bible. And I can find it later if anyone's interested.
You have surfed to Jackson Snyder Presents
produced by the Vero Essen Yahad, a Hebrew Nation radio original. We'll be right back after this break. Clouds of Glory, Jackson Snyder Presents, is back.
Yom Teruah is the day of war, the feast of trumpets and the court of law. Sound of the shofar in the
So, I mean, surprising outcome so far.
We were talking about Hatshepsut being content when she sort of assumed the rulership of Egypt to continue with trade and to make lots of profit for Egypt using these merchants that were developing and settling in all of these areas that they'd conquered. Now, that was giving rise to sort of a merchant class, a middle class, because before that it had only been the rulers, the kings and all the nobles and the priests and then serfs or people who worked land and didn't really own anything, and some artisans, but they were simple, serving the people's basic needs. And then the ones who were artisans for the rulers were actually in the priesthood and did all the carving and artwork for them then. Well, her son, and I got to go find my genealogy here. I got it on here. Was it Thutmose III? Okay. Or I don't know if it was, yes. No, it must have been Amenhotep II. Okay. Was against, she was ruling as a regent for him until he got old enough to rule. And she wanted to keep this peaceful thing going on and make lots of profit. Well, her son was, it was either her son or her nephew. I'm not real clear on that. He was coached by other members of his family that they needed to go back and reestablish their military forces in these areas because they were losing control to the merchants. And the merchants were cutting deals with the local people, and the military might was diminishing. Well, when he came into power, he reestablished some of the military influence. And in fact, Thutmose IV continued along those veins. Amenhotep III, who was Akhenaten's father, started to let things slide again because there was almost a civil war going on between the merchant class and the nobility class, because the merchant class had expanded and colonized these areas and was making pretty good money, and the military had lost support of the rulers and wasn't built up enough, so that the merchant class were actually, like I said, cutting their own deals with the local populace, which led to a power struggle, which was summarily put down by the pharaoh. I believe it was Thutmose IV. And so, but you still had this group of people who had just become disenfranchised by the pharaoh. So the thought was that these people were the ones that Akhenaten was appealing to. He was using some different kind of artwork. He was using artisan type artwork instead of the royal priesthood artwork. So there, and he wasn't going to send the military back out because I think he was supported greatly by this merchant class and by the more common people. And that sort of falls into a lot of things that we read, we've been talking about what they have found at Amarna. You know, there were, it was a complete settlement. They could make their own pottery and glass. They had agriculture and vineyards. They had it was a self-sustaining city, and everyone seemed to be less formal and more equal than they had been under the previous pharaohs. And this ties in a little later. Sorry, I'm going to go back to reading the book. I'm sorry, I had to divert there, give a little background. All right, so remarkably, Akhenaten did little to counteract the foreign revolts and generally ignored his allies' calls for help. Under his reign, Egypt's Canaanite Empire collapsed. The state of affairs continued throughout the balance of the 18th dynasty. Although many Egyptologists assumed that Horemheb, the last king of the dynasty, reinstituted much of Egypt's authority in Canaan, no evidence to that effect exists. Indeed, shortly after his death, records depict Sethos I attempting to recapture control all along the routes leading from Egypt into Canaan. More important than Akhenaten's inattention to foreign affairs was the domestic religious revolution wrought in his name. Ill-prepared to be king after his father's designated heir died prematurely, Akhenaten assumed the throne under the name Amenhotep, a name that recognized the Theban view of Amen as the chief deity in Egypt. Beginning in the fifth year of his reign, life in Egypt changed. Akhenaten launched a religious revolution that had a profound impact on Egypt's religious affairs. This new religion held that only one deity, Re Harakhti, manifests in the form of Aten, the sun disk. No other gods were to be worshipped, and graven images of deity were banned. Representations of Amun, the chief deity of Thebes, were not only prohibited, but the god's name and image were physically removed from all monuments all over Egypt. Akhenaten also downplayed the role of Osiris in funeral rituals, a central feature of Egyptian life. Understandably, Akhenaten's reforms greatly disturbed the Theban establishment that until then controlled Egypt. The chief priest of Akhenaten's new cult may have been named Osarsef, but in conformity with the pharaoh's directive prohibiting the use of personal names containing the name of an unacceptable deity as an element, Osarsef changed his name to either Hormos or Ramos. In this important role, Osarsef administered the religious reforms that so offended the Theban establishment and its national network. No doubt the Thebans saw in him the cause of all that angered them. He became the focus of their wrath. Now, they are equating this priest, Osarsef, with Moses because his name was changed to either Hormos, which is H-O-R-M-O-S-E, or Ramos, which is R-A-M-O-S-E. Just to give you an aside. As a part of his break with Theban tradition, Akhenaten expended much of his energy on building a new capital city, Akhetaten. Like any capital, it became an important residential section for the new political and religious establishment. The city provided economic benefits to tens of thousands of Egyptians. It housed soldiers, priests, a massive civil service, laborers for the ongoing construction projects, merchants, important families, and the commercial network for such a city to survive. In order to control the rest of Egypt, he needed tens of thousands of additional personnel serving around the country and under his control, especially troops to put down resistance, priests to manage the religious reforms, and civil servants to do his bidding. Akhenaten showed little genius for administrative skills, and whatever success he enjoyed stemmed from the abilities of his civil service, with Osarsef at its head. Another power behind the throne was Ai, an ambitious general and social climber with close ties to Akhenaten. In about his 16th year on the throne, the pharaoh appointed Smenkhkare, a blood relative, as his co-regent. Akhenaten died a year later, and Smenkhkare succeeded to the throne. 2 years later, he also died. We do not know much about the internal politics behind the succession, but it led to the elevation of the young child Tukhenhaten as pharaoh. Although a blood relative to Akhenaten, he served as a pawn of the Theban establishment. Upon taking the throne, he changed his name to Tutankhamun, thus signaling the ouster of the Aten cult and the return to the Theban establishment to power. In all likelihood, this arrangement arose from a deal with Ai, the military power behind Tutankhamun, who carefully sought to placate any threats to his own power base and personal political agenda. The reemergence of the Theban establishment meant the immediate diminution in authority of the Aten cult. Osarsef, now the de facto and perhaps de jure head of Akhenaten's priesthood, represented the main threat to continued Theban prominence. They had to eliminate him, and he knew it. He fled Egypt, probably at first to Ethiopia, since he was not only already situated far to the south, but also because the way to Canaan would have been more heavily guarded and more difficult to pass through. The Bible does say that Moses had an Ethiopian wife, and this may have been one of Osarsef's links to that country, or he may have met her after he arrived there. Osarsef may also have had connections with Ethiopians anxious to weaken Egyptian authority. That nation had been an independent territory subjected to Egyptian domination for centuries. In the Hyksos period, it appears to have been more closely allied to the foreigners than to the Thebans, despite its southern location below Thebes. At first, the Thebans allowed the Aten cult to continue, albeit without anything resembling its earlier role. No doubt some degree of caution prevailed. Too swift a retribution could have provoked a counter-revolution, and Thebes needed time to consolidate. Tutankhamun died after 9 years, and I emerged from behind the throne to the front seat. He served 4 years and left no heir of royal blood. This opened the way for the popular general Horemheb to become king. Close to the Theban establishment, he had little hesitation about taking on the Aten cult, launching a systematic campaign to eliminate every trace of the Atenist heresy. He demolished the capital city of Akhetaten, chiseled out all references to the Aten and Akhenaten in monuments all across the country, and integrated a campaign of persecution against the more influential elements of the cult. Such an effort had a devastating impact on the followers of Akhenaten. The loss of their capital city with its attendant financial resources, the loss of contributions to their priesthood, forced labor, the confiscation of their property, the punishment of leaders, the banishing of soldiers, all worked to create a permanent underclass seething with anger. Osarsef, like Moses in the Bible, heard the cry of suffering from his people and could only wait for his God to deliver them from oppression. And as is in the Bible, the Pharaoh of oppression died. Horemheb ruled for about 27 years, dying at about 1315 BC. In his final days, he appointed Ramses I to the throne. Shortly thereafter, Ramses I appointed his son Sethos I co-regent. Ramses I, like Horemheb, was a general without royal blood, but he was a northerner, not from Thebes, and he was from a family of Set worshippers, as signified by the name of his son in the celebration of the foundation of Avaris, the Hyksos capital. The elevation of a northern Set worshipping Hyksos appeasing pharaoh could not have occurred without some difficulty in Thebes and other parts of Egypt and its empire. Perhaps this was the sign Osarsef waited for. Sensing the opportunity for rebellion and a rehabilitation of the Atenist cult, Osarsef organized a military alliance aimed at overthrowing Ramses I. In the north, he induced the kingdom of Shechem to join him. In the south, he probably had Ethiopian contingents. And throughout the country, there were the remnants of the Aten cult, the displaced allies who wanted revenge. To these, we must add disparate groups of resenters, power seekers, mercenaries, and opportunists, a mixed multitude of non-Atenists. Osarsef launched a two-front attack from the Shechemites in the north and his own troops in the south. Soon after, the Shechemites were stopped at the Egyptian borders, but Osarsef had a large enough force to hold his ground in the south. Eventually, the two sides negotiated a peace treaty, granting safe passage out of Egypt for Osarsef, his army, and their families. This negotiated departure from Egypt constituted the Exodus. The civil war between the forces of Osarsef and the armies of the Pharaoh appear in the Bible, along with the negotiations for safe passage, as the story of the Ten Plagues, an epic account drawing upon Egyptian literary conventions to describe events. Osarsef, or Moses, to use the shortened form of his adopted name, Ramos or Hormos, settled his entourage in the area associated with the tribe of Reuben. As was common in ancient times, people tended to identify foundation settlements with the mythical ancestor, and in later Israelite writings, this mystical ancestor came to be known as Reuben. Because this territory served as the first homeland of Israel, Reuben, according to the conventional mythological grammar, came to be known as the firstborn son of Jacob. The armies of Moses probably continued to have a close relationship with the kingdom of Shechem. But as Sethos I and then Ramesses II brought much of Canaan back within the sphere of Egyptian influence, Shechem ceased to be the large kingdom that it had been in the times of Akhenaten. Genesis 34 even hints at a political break between Israel and Shechem sometime in the course of their alliance. Over time, the Israelites and Reuben spread out into central Jordan and then across the river into largely unoccupied hills of central Canaan, establishing many small communities throughout the land. From the hills in Canaan, further settlements spread north and south. At the same time that Israel moved into the central highlands, Canaan experienced several waves of invasion from the powerful Sea Peoples Confederation, chief of which were the Philistines. Led by Greek warrior castes, the Sea People established strong roots in this new territory and on several occasions, most notably during the reigns of Merneptah around 1239 to 1229 BC and Ramesses III around 1197 to 1166 BC, they battled fiercely against Egypt itself. The pressures exerted by the Sea Peoples in Canaan and against Egypt may have provided the cover that allowed the Israelites to smoothly cross over the Jordan and easily settle into the central highlands. Despite the biblical allegations, at this time Israel had no tribal structure. They may have had influential families, political factions, and some settlements with special military strengths, but there were no tribes. As evidenced by the Song of Deborah, the subsequent tribal divisions reflected the growth and merger of territorial bases. As was common in Canaan and throughout the Middle East, occasionally one king or another became more powerful than his neighbors and flexed his military muscle and political power. One such person in this pre-monarchical period, mentioned both in the Song of Deborah and the Book of Joshua, appears to have been a northern Canaanite king named Jabin, who may have dominated much of the north and central Canaanite territories. Simultaneous rival pressures came from the coastal territories associated with the Philistines. The evidence suggested by the Song of Deborah indicates that the Israelites in central Canaan formed an alliance with the leaders of several northern city-states, some of which may have been Sea People strongholds. Out of this alliance grew the entity of a Greater Israel, which served as the model for what later came to be known as Israel's Tribal Confederation. While Israel's allies shared political and military allegiances, they did not share religious views. In addition, many of the Egyptians who left Egypt with Moses did not subscribe to Atenist orthodoxy. The presence of Canaanite, Greek, and Egyptian deities and priests within the Israelite ranks fueled dissension among mainstream Atenists, leading to a variety of conflicts, intrigues, and schisms. It is at about this point in history that our inquiry into Israel's origin ends. Shortly thereafter, the monarchy emerged. Under King David, a fusion of ideals seems to have taken place. On the one hand, he established the Orthodox Atenist view as the central religion of ancient Israel. On the other, however, he and Solomon after him seems to have encouraged all the other factions to worship in their own way as long as they recognize the fundamental supremacy of the Atenist priesthood. Much of the subsequent Israelite writing about this time revolves around these religious feuds and schisms. It is an interesting theory that this man has produced, and there is a lot of archaeological, historical background to it. But he is using a dating system that it's several chapters long. It shows how that the patriarchs of Israel were born and died at certain points to match up to the earlier dynasties of the Egyptian rulers. It also is basing the biblical genealogy timelines on the Masoretic version. So it gives the date of Joseph's birth, his year, as 1564 BC, and his death year is 1454 BC. It follows back and forward using the biblical number of years for the lifespans of everyone to calculate the date. So I don't know if it is an accurate timeline that he's using to match with the archaeological findings or not. I mean, there is data there, But it's the interpretation of the data that gives this guy's theory wings and lets it work. If you interpret it a different way, this is all just a theory. There's no way to prove it. But it's interesting, and there is quite a lot about this Osarsef character and how it very well could have been Moses. He would have been educated alongside Akhenaten, and either he was Egyptian or he had been adopted in. But the whole story, the whole Moses story, is very much like one of the Egyptian myths about their gods. I think it's Set and Horus, and how they there was a whole lot of similarity between the Moses story and the Egyptian stories. So they think that maybe the people sort of combined everything together and made a fusion of it over time, not necessarily intentionally. It's just how it evolved. But they placed Joseph, if in fact he was a real human and not just a semi-mythic person, earlier in the reign of, hold on, I've got to find my note, Thutmose the First, who reigned from 1534 to 1521. Now, it's possible if he was a real person and he did have a monotheistic view that he did everything that is said in the scripture in influencing the pharaohs and that whole bloodline, and they had that in their mind, and this is how the Aten theory worked out several generations later. So
excellent constructive criticism. Let me add to that a couple of things. Going back to what I was trying to say earlier and lost my recording, in back of this, the religious dots that we try to put together concerning Yeb and Jebus, if you take that name Jebus and bring it down to the actual name of the place, it would be Yeb too, because the U.S. on the end of Jebus is a Latin nominative suffix, and G-E-B, that's Y-E-B, so we've got a Yeb in Egypt, and a Yeb that was going to be Jerusalem. We have these priests of Yahweh in Jebus or Yeb before David conquered that place. And we have then, undoubtedly in my mind, there's a scholarly theory that kind of backs this up, David and the priest Zadok of Yeb worked together to conquer that area that they called Benjamin, and that already the Yeb that was Jerusalem was worshiping in accordance with monotheism. The Bible says that they worship El Elyon, the great high God. And so David, he all of a sudden has a high priest from outside the Levitical order, whose name is Zadok, remembering that Melchizedek was 19th century BC wise man, king, and priest of the Most High as well. So we've got three places here in 1,000 years. You've got Yeb that became Jerusalem. You've got Yeb that was Elephantine Island. And you have Akhetaten that you wonder where all these dispersed people that Allison was talking about went to. And the theory, of course, is that they went up to Goshen, that they went down to Yeb, the island, that they went on down to Cush, to a place called Alfe, and on down south of that.
This is your host. Thank you for listening. I hope you've enjoyed our variety show, Jackson Snyder Presents. This is a presentation of the Vero Essen Yahad in Vero Beach, Florida. If you would like more information about today's broadcast, email jackson@hebrewnation.net or visit hebrewnationonline.com. Until we meet again, may Yahweh keep you safe and close to home.
Be continued tomorrow night, Third Temple, Part 5. If you're listening on Podbean, after this outro, we will continue on.